Wings thanks Rebel Podcast Network for carrying our programs and urges listeners to contribute to their fundraiser. Please visit rabble.ca/donate today.
This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's radio. Radio.
Today on Wings, Sister Carolyn Gage presents another of her famous lesbian tent revival sermons, one that even non-lesbians can learn from.
Toxic self-sufficiency, sisters, can threaten the life of the whole planet.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Welcome to the Lesbian Tent Revival Radio Hour. This is Sister Carolyn of the Sisterhood of the Sacred Synapse bringing you the good news of sisterhood and feminism. We're going to be talking about one of the occupational hazards of being a lesbian. Something to be proud of, something you can't have too much of, but you actually can. And it's funny how sometimes in life the cure can end up being worse than the condition it's supposed to fix. Sisters, I'm talking about self-sufficiency. I know. For lesbians, that's historically been an especially good thing and even a necessity. Because when you depend on folks, you find out you have to please them or do things the way they think you should. And that didn't usually include making love to other women. And many of us found out that if we were going to live the lesbian lives we wanted, we would need to be pretty damn self-sufficient. And also, that's been historically one of the great things about our lesbian partnerships. They tended to be more egalitarian than heterosexual partnerships because nobody took for granted that one partner should be the breadwinner. And society wasn't set up to pay one partner automatically 30% more than the other for doing the same work. When two self-sufficient women came together to make a household, it could be a very beautiful thing. So why is Sister Carolyn preaching the evils of self-sufficiency? Well, because too much of a good thing is too much of a good thing, and too much self-sufficiency becomes toxic. It's like pouring Miracle-Gro fertilizer on a control freak. But it's also a situation where we can start to believe our own propaganda, not just personally, but also as an entire society or nation. And toxic self-sufficiency, sisters, can threaten the life of the whole planet. So today we're going to look at this self-sufficiency thing, and we're going to look hard. Now, there was a great geoscientist named Lynn Margulis. She is one of the great saints of the lesbian tent revival, St. Lynn Margulis. And why? Because she wrote a book that's even more important than Charles Darwin's Origin of the Species. But there's a number of reasons why her book is never going to achieve the level of fame of Origin of the Species, and isn't that always the way? But that's not what I want to talk about, and besides, most of y'all can figure that out for yourselves. Anyway, her great book that no one will hear about is titled The Symbiotic Planet, Evolution by Merger. And what is great about this book is her theory of evolution, which she calls the Gaia concept. And we know that's a kind of goddess term for the whole of nature. Now, a theory of evolution explains how things got to be the way they are. And a theory of evolution is packed with values. It's kind of like a form of religion. A theory of evolution presents a working model for the universe. That's why people get so heated up over theories of evolution, like the creationists who insist that a big patriarch in the sky made the whole world in 7 calendar days, and the whole theory of evolution, of course, blows out to smithereens. So anyway, the most commonly known and taught theory of evolution is the one by Charles Darwin. In 1859, Charles Darwin published The Origin of the Species, the book that made a monkey out of creation theory. Darwin's theory of evolution was about survival of the fittest. Yeah, survival of the fittest. Random genetic mutations that would lead to natural selection, whereby the more rugged or adaptive species would multiply and be fruitful, while the less rugged, and there you can read violent, rapacious, less adaptive species would die out. In other words, according to Darwin, competition was good for us. And this led to something called social Darwinism, a convenient rationale for rampant and predatory capitalism that characterized the Industrial Revolution and which continues under various guises to manifest itself today, with results like the horrifying fire in the clothing factory in Bangladesh, where over 1,000 workers lost their lives. It's social Darwinism to outsource our manufacturing to countries that have lower wages and fewer laws protecting the workers and the environment. Competition, sisters, competition is a natural order of the universe. Get tough or die. But Margulis looked at the numbers, and they just don't add up. In her book, she makes the point that genetic mutations, although common and easy to induce, rarely lead to changes that are beneficial to the organism. In other words, one's chances for becoming the lucky host of an advantageous change in DNA structure are worse than those for winning the lottery. And the chances are even slimmer of becoming the founder of a new species based on such a rare mutation. Well, so how did we evolve from pond scum if it wasn't by Darwinian competition and natural selection? Now, y'all bear with me. I know you're thinking, what the hell is this science lecture? I thought she's talking about dykes. Well, I am, so listen up. Margulis argues that evolutionary advances are achieved not by good genes and natural selection, but by a species' success in achieving symbiotic mergers with other species. Now stay with me here. Symbiosis means good for both parties. Yeah, so think about your relationships. That'll get your attention. It's a dynamic that makes each partner stronger than they would be on their own. Wow, it could not be more opposite from rugged individualism and competition. Success in achieving symbiotic mergers with other species. And as I said, Lynn called her theory the Gaia concept, and in scientific terms, she defined it as a serial endosymbiosis theory of evolution. But y'all can just say the Gaia concept. What does that mean in lay terms? Well, actually, something pretty well understood by a lot of lesbians. The Gaia concept means that we evolve not by rugged individualism and competition, but by relationships. Not just between plants and animals, but also between atmospheric gases, surface rocks, and water, all of which she maintains are regulated by the growth, death, integration, and other activities of living organisms, as we are finding out as we heat up the planet and deplete the ozone, and so on. In other words, it's the entire ecosystem of the Earth's surface as a series of interacting ecosystems, and this is definitely not your grandmother's theory of evolution. Symbiotic mergers. Sisters, as lesbians, we have not been known for achieving symbiotic mergers with each other, much less with other species. We lesbians are known for unhealthy for both merging identity mergers, or else we're known for attempting mergers, kind of like in our collectives, that have a way of blowing up in our faces. Or we just give up and practice good old-fashioned patriarchal dominance and submission, which is pretty much the universal model for interacting with the environment, except for the indigenous cultures following traditional ways. And then, of course, lesbians actually really are not that noted for mergers at all, but often most noted for our rugged individualism. In other words, don't tell me what to do. So that's why we're talking about this today. So now we're going to peek into Margulis' book, and we're going to look at some examples, and maybe we can learn something from them. Now, explaining to a layperson how symbiosis works, she uses the example of lichen. You know, that green stuff that sticks on the rocks. Lichen is a combination of two organisms that are living in a mutually beneficial arrangement. So you just think of a healthy couple. Most of the lichen is composed of fungal filaments, but among these filaments are green algal cells. That's algae. So if the lichen is submerged in water, the fungus is going to die out, but the algae will proliferate. On the other hand, if there's an inadequate amount of sunlight to sustain the algae photosynthesis, then it's going to die out, but the fungus is going to live on. So the algae gains a structure that enables it to live on land, and the fungus benefits from the food-making capacity of the algae. Together, they are tougher, more resilient, more likely to survive, more likely to reproduce themselves than singly. All right, so moving to mammals for examples of symbiosis. Margulis describes a cow, not as an entity, but as a 50-gallon fermentation vat. Mm-hmm. The cow does not digest the grass it eats. The grass is digested by the organisms that are growing symbiotically inside its gut. Which brings us to the human colon. Yes, sisters, for the sake of the planet, let us consider the mighty colon. Let's think respectfully about the colon. Now, the colon is host to the bacteria that constitute the largest percentage of the dry weight of the human body. Mm-hmm. The colon is host to the bacteria that constitute the largest percentage of the dry weight of the human body. On the planet, there's 17 families of bacteria with 50 different genera. Within this, there are hundreds of species and subspecies. There's somewhere between 400 and 500 is the estimated amount in a single person. A lot of different kinds, huge variety of bacteria in the colon. And whether we like it or not, these bacteria constitute a de facto lower GI tract tenants association. And when we're not eating with proper symbiotic respect for the needs of the bacteria in our gut, they die out, and the more harmful ones proliferate, and we find, like most slumlords do, that low-life tenants have a way of making their problems into problems for the landlords. Unhappy colon bacteria can form pockets of resistance, trash the place, or stage a sit-down strike. That's one of the reasons why we need to eat intelligently and not eat a bunch of crap that the bacteria never evolved to handle and can't even recognize. But anyway, it's not my focus today to talk about the digestive system. I just want to point out it evolved not by survival of the most rugged, self-sufficient, stainless steel gut that could digest all kinds of crap because it was so damn tough. No, you might think that's true, but that's not. The colon evolved through a very delicate balance, a rich symbiosis of relationships with all kinds of colonies of other living beings that live there. It didn't get resilient by kicking out all other forms of life, but by inviting them in, working with them, and developing this incredible balance, which, before all that processed food, the colon was perfectly adapted to the food that was in our environment. Anyway, so we feed them, and in exchange, they aid in digestion for us. If we eat crap they can't digest, they die, the food's not digested, we don't absorb nutrients from it. Bacteria, housemates. Colon housemates. So as below, so above. As the colon goes, so goes the planet. We survive individually the best when we are in a rich, delicately balanced symbiotic mergers with other humans and other forms of life and the rocks and the weather and the rivers and the ocean. We're good to them, they're good to us. As a planet and as individuals, we have to take St. Margulis's Gaia concept very seriously. We have to move away from natural selection, which is kind of a contradiction in terms. Remember what it felt like to get picked for a team in middle school? The whole notion of selection seems predicated on selfishness and grandiosity. Nothing natural about it. So let's move from natural selection to the Gaia concept, symbiotic merger. This is a radical, radical rerouting of our synapses. It goes from picking the team to everybody plays. Now, sisters, I know there's a lot of us who grasp the importance of recycling and boycotting Monsanto and cutting greenhouse emissions, but who are not so keen to see the importance of symbiosis in our personal relationships. Many of us are morbidly attached to toxic levels of self-sufficiency, proud of it, and toxic because that's just what they are. They put us outside symbiotic systems that support the planet. With our self-sufficiency, we can end up isolating ourselves. We can end up hoarding. We can lie to ourselves. We can think we're doing fine when we're actually heading over a cliff of major and total breakdown and dependency. We can feel superior. We can be judgmental about others who are not so seemingly self-sufficient. Now, Sister Carolyn speaks with authority here, as she usually does when it's something she's done badly, because she used to take pride in the fact she didn't ask for help. Like that was a good thing. She used to think she took care of herself, except, of course, for those occasions where she'd have some kind of breakdown or some kind of meltdown from an accumulation of unmet and usually unconscious needs. And these would be seen as events outside her control, some kind of strange episode. And then as soon as she was back on her feet again, she'd go back to the belief she was self-sufficient until the next breakdown. And what about her friends? Don't you just love it when I talk about myself in third person? Kind of confuses me sometimes. Well, when I had a breakdown or a meltdown, my friends didn't have a lot of options. They either showed up for me because they cared, or else they kind of had to abandon me because they actually had lives of their own. It was pretty black or white, on the bus or off the bus. Not given a lot of options or any kind of advance warning. Kind of a squeeze play when you fall apart suddenly or have a breakdown. Yeah, and that's how I used to be. And then I learned that asking for help early and often was a good thing. And that really ground my gears, sisters. I got to tell you, I spent decades honing my ability to never ask for help. And suddenly I'm figuring out I'm supposed to do it early and often. And that when I ask for help early, the problem isn't that big yet. It's not that overwhelming. It's not that urgent. And when I ask for help often, I have to get a pretty large roster of friends to contact so I don't have to burn out any one person. But this means that when I do call and ask people for help early and often, they can say no pretty comfortably because I'm not in a crisis. And I can tell them, you know, I actually have a list of other folks I can contact if this isn't a good time or it's not going to work for you to help me out with this. And here's the thing that's so amazing. When I started asking for help early and often, I actually stopped having breakdowns and meltdowns. Instead, I started having good days and bad days. And that was a symbiotic thing for everybody involved. As I didn't enjoy my breakdowns and neither did anybody else, I just didn't understand why I was having them. See, here's the thing. Nobody can meet all their own needs all the time. And when we think we do, what's actually happening is we're building up a store of unmet needs in the sub-basement of our subconscious. And the more we tell ourselves we're being self-sufficient, the more we're stuffing down needs, and one day they're just going to explode and bring down the whole house, and that's when we have that damn breakdown, and our friends have to drop what they're doing and come pick up the pieces. But here's another thing. When the needs are all subterranean like that, we actually are desperate. We are. We may not think it. Doesn't matter how competent we look. Sooner or later, all the chickens come home to roost. All of them. That's right, sisters. They sure do. And that desperation can suck our friends dry. Now, we have probably all dated or worked for folks who are desperate but didn't know it. And they don't have normal interactions with us. We're sitting there trying to talk to them, you know, back and forth like a ping pong ball, but they're not playing. What they're doing is they're filtering, they're scavenging the conversation, they're siphoning us emotionally, they're picking through our words trying to figure out what they could chomp on because they are starving to death with unmet needs. And they might end up trying to hypnotize or paralyze us so they can feed on our life force, our vital energy, and they don't even know they're doing that. Because when you're desperate, sometimes you don't let your right hand know what your left hand's doing. When you have a wildly unmanageable mountain of unmet needs, you're not really in control of what you're doing. You think you're doing something, but you're not. And we come away feeling drained. We're not sure why. We just kind of figure we're going to avoid that person next time around. But here's the thing, sisters. They can't help it, and we can't help it. If we're loaded with unmet needs, we can't control ourselves. We are sucking on a subconscious level, scanning and siphoning all the time, not really being present. The only way to be accountable is to be sure we don't have this basement of unmet needs when we come to the table of human interactions. And then we don't have to ambush our friends with breakdowns and crises and take them hostage and do all that stuff. Now here's the thing with a toxic self-sufficiency. It's kind of a folie de deux. That's French. Now, folie de deux is a French term meaning a madness of two. And it happens when two people transmit delusional beliefs back and forth. Like one person says, I'm the Queen of France, and the other one bows and says, indeed you are, Your Highness. And as long as your whole world is just that other person, you can just, you know, really go on with that Queen of France stuff. Folie de deux. But I think folie de deux can happen between a person and her self-sufficiency, all by herself. I think she can look in the mirror and say, look, I'm pretty self-sufficient, aren't I? and her self-sufficiency looks back at her and at her checkbook or her job or her backyard full of homegrown vegetables and says, "You sure are." And then she says, "So I don't need anything from anyone, do I?" And the self-sufficiency looks back and says, "No, you don't. Good job. You're better off that way because other people can abandon you and hurt you." And this goes on back and forth, the dyke and her self-sufficiency, and they're congratulating each other on their great wisdom and not needing anyone else. And sisters, this is folie de deux, because the self-sufficiency is a myth that makes a lot of assumptions. Assumptions like my job will last forever, or my health will last forever, or the economy is going to be strong, it's a joke, and a dollar today is going to buy the same thing in a year or 10 years. Like, when did that ever happen? All kinds of assumptions. The fact of the matter is this. Our self-sufficiency may collapse at any time. Ask anyone who's been bitten by itty-bitty Lyme disease-infected tick. Boom! Whole world screeched to a halt. Ask anyone who's had an uninsured fire. Ask anyone who has a business based on working with a partner who up and leaves. Hell, ask anyone who had a 401k in 2008. Understanding the world is an unsafe place is real uncomfortable, sisters. People would rather upload a myth about self-sufficiency than really accept there are huge factors that can impact our welfare any minute over which we have zero control. That's damn near unbearable. So we get all these ideas of if I just make X amount of money and I get X amount of level in my business and blah, 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 I'm made. I'm self-sufficient. I got the future nailed down. That's what we tell ourselves. It's like a fairy tale. But sisters, we got to be synapsing fully because that kind of thinking has gotten the planet in a lot of trouble, and we'll get to that in a minute. But if we embrace our lack of security, we can actually achieve some level of security. Kind of a little conundrum there. We can develop a wide network of symbiotic relationships that will buffer us from all kinds of weird catastrophes, far better than our toxic self-sufficiency, because that wide network of symbiotic relationships is chock full of skill sets we know nothing about. And usually the thing that crashes our security comes from someplace we did not expect at all. And rather than stockpiling money in the bank or, you know, canned goods in the pantry, far better to stockpile friends, tons of those mergers. Because that is going to be a system that is wildly adaptive to all kinds of crazy catastrophes. The most truly self-sufficient people understand that self-sufficiency is a myth. And I'm just going to tell a little story here. I had two people in my life who took great pride in living off the grid and not needing anyone or anything. And one of them was found in a coma in his cabin up in the mountains of Colorado, leukemia. Had to be flown back to his family in Maryland and ended his life with a barrage of arguably toxic medical treatments over which he had zero control, which may actually have done more harm than good. The other one discovered that the terrible nightmare of her childhood vulnerability that she had spent her adult lifetime trying to escape by becoming so thoroughly independent she didn't need anybody. I mean, she dug her own well, she raised her own chickens, she raised her own produce. She found out that the nightmare she was trying to escape caught up to her all of a sudden in the form of complex PTSD when she was in her 30s. It was misdiagnosed, and she ended up desperately dependent on a subsidized medical system providing her with absolutely abysmal health care, setting her up for addiction to a slew of psychotropic drugs, which rendered her too fatigued to maintain the farm, led to suicidal ideation and eventual death. And I had another friend who spent her entire life building her own business, making sure she was in control of every aspect of her life. And for years, she paid into long-term health care so that she would be in control of things even when she was too old to be in control of them. And then she picked out one of the most expensive, fancy assisted living communities to move to. And when she got there, she found out the level of homophobia was absolutely unmanageable, miserable. Turns out that quality of life had nothing to do with how much money she had. And it really sucks, sisters, that so many of us learn not to trust people. And it sucks that self-sufficiency doesn't really work. It really does. We should be able to control things by controlling things. And I have tried, sisters. I have really tried, and I do try from time to time. But the truth of the matter is, it does not work. You know it, I know it. It doesn't work. And let's take a moment right now to honor the words of St. Julia Penelope. These are some incredible words of wisdom. She said, I have learned that when I believe myself to be most in control of my mind, my body, my life, I was least in control. When I would have declared and believed that I was on top of relationships and events in my life, I was most the victim of my past and the consequences of my experiences. Realizing this in my own life, I have come to believe that the most damaging idea we've learned from our culture is the equation of power with control and its corollary, the identification of control with autonomy and independence. Think about that, sisters. The most damaging idea is to equate power with control. There's power in those symbiotic mergers. There's no control, because you know it's coalition. You give up a lot of control in coalition. But there's power in that. And there's no power in controlling things. This is a huge shift for us as individuals. It's a huge shift for the planet. But here in the U.S., our self-sufficiency, and I put that in quotes, has been based on oil. And we are discovering that we are alarmingly vulnerable because of that. We've had lower oil prices than other countries for decades and congratulated ourselves on our political leverage in achieving that and what an advantage that's given us in industry. But other countries with the more realistic oil prices have been busily converting to wind and solar technologies, and we're waking up to find out that we were the suckers, not them. We fancy ourselves to be self-sufficient, but we forget we are now dependent on cheap overseas labor, on China, who holds most of our debt, on an environment that is rapidly becoming depleted because we weren't paying attention to that. Sisters, we have to lie to ourselves here in the States about so many things in order to pretend that we are some mighty self-sufficient nation. Big shifts for all of us. That whole Gaia concept, this symbiotic merger model, so opposite from competition, survival of the fittest. But this is the good news, sisters. Listen up. Your colon gets it. Your colon gets the idea of symbiotic mergers. Your colon is living that truth right now, right here. And every time you expel methane gas, you know you are experiencing the tangible blessing of symbiotic merger in those hosts of friendly bacteria who get free groceries in exchange for digesting them for us. And I do believe that we have the capacity to become as intelligent as our colons. This is not true right now. We have trashed the planet. But I hold that hope that someday we can learn to be as smart as our colons. I believe we can, and of course I believe with the lesbian advantage that we definitely as lesbians ought to be able to do that. We just need to wrap our heads around our colon, which is the opposite of having our heads up our asses. Because that's what toxic self-sufficiency is all about. All right? Blessed be.
That was the Sermon on Toxic Self-Sufficiency from the series Sermons for a Lesbian Tent Revival, written and performed by Sister Carolyn Gage. Originally from the south of the U.S., Gage travels widely performing sermons and her many plays focused on lesbian herstory and life. You can find more on her website, carolyngage.com. That's Carolyn with a Y, CarolynGage.com. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose new book is titled The Gift in the Heart of Language, The Maternal Source of Meaning. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.